Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This message comes from OnPoint's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you qualify, and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point. 1 year after the deadly rally in Charlottesville, fewer than 40 white nationalists marched yesterday in Washington, drowned out by a sea of counter-protesters. But across the country, violence against minorities and immigrants persists. Hate crimes are up across the United States. The president's critics point to President Trump's rhetoric as a driving force. This hour on Point, hate in America. You can join us on air or online. Have you experienced or witnessed a hate crime? How did it affect you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Arjun Singh Sethi. He's a civil rights lawyer and editor of a new book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Arjun, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is the origin of this book?
Well, hate pre-existed Donald Trump. Hate will endure after Donald Trump. But there is no doubt that Donald Trump's rhetoric and policies have emboldened hate in every facet of American life, whether it's in schools, universities, the workplace, and public life. And as a community activist, I thought it was critical to travel the country, document the stories of survivors, check in with them, and see how they are enduring and rebuilding despite losing so much.
Is there a specific moment that you can point to that is it a gradual process, or is there a moment that says, this is a book that I need to oversee?
I think it's a gradual process. Again, I work closely with vulnerable communities, Muslim, Arab, South Asian, Sikh communities. And what I was hearing during the 2016 presidential election campaign was that hate was spiking. And really, that spike continued through the election, inauguration, and now under the administration of Donald Trump.
Is this book born out of a particular incident that happened to you, perhaps, in the past?
It isn't, but my personal identity is relevant to the book. I am a Sikh American, and I can be readily identified by my articles of faith, which include my long hair, which I cover with a turban, and a beard. Sikh Americans are acutely vulnerable to bullying in the classroom, hate violence generally, and in some cases, police profiling. Just in connection with this book, I was nearly driven off the road in Tulsa, Oklahoma. In Kalispell, Montana.
Let's stay with that for a second. Give us the particulars of that. What precipitated that?
Sure. I had actually just finished meeting the family of Khalid Jabara, one of the profiles in the book, and I was driving to the airport, and somebody was tailgating me. Maybe I was driving slow. I don't know. The car then pulled up on my left, and when the gentleman in the car saw that I was wearing a turban, he became enraged. He started mimicking my turban, yelling at me, and then sort of swerved his car. And then I immediately pulled over to the side because I genuinely feared for my life that day.
Can you tell us a bit more about the actual story that you were there to report on or to find out more about? This is a Lebanese-American family in Tulsa?
Absolutely. So the Jabaras are Arab Christians, and they fled the Lebanese Civil War and settled in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And they made a nice life for themselves, and all was well until a white supremacist moved next door, who really terrorized them. He called them things like dirty Muslims, dirty Arabs, ISIS. And then in 2015, this next-door neighbor actually ran over Haifa Jabara, the mother of the family. The suspect was arrested, but because a new prosecutor was appointed to the case, he was allowed to post bond, was returned next door to the family he had terrorized, and then months later murdered Khalid Jabara on his front doorstep.
Social media and camera phones have become instrumental in documenting hate crimes in public. In this instance, a Muslim woman in California recorded an altercation with a man who confronted her about wearing a hijab.
Why? What's wrong with me?
I don't know. Will you tell me what's wrong with you?
Do you know I'm a Muslim?
Yeah, I do.
What's your problem with that?
I don't like it. How's that?
Why?
I don't like that because I don't like your religion. It says to kill me and I don't want to be killed by you. How's that?
Are you scared of me?
Is there a notion that when you talk about there, you sense there was a spike in hate crimes? Is there a notion of that is the case, or as we often hear, everything is recorded now, the camera is always on, so we are much more aware of when these things happen?
Well, let me speak to data in general. So according to the FBI, there were roughly 6,000 hate crimes committed in 2016. But according to a survey like the National Crime Victimization Survey, there are as many as 250,000 hate crimes that happen every year. So the data that we get from the FBI is incomplete because it relies on voluntary reporting from law enforcement, not mandatory. So I just wanted to make that clear first for the listeners. So I think it's great that we have citizen journalists and folks in the media who are helping document hate. But if you speak to survivors and you speak to impacted communities and marginalized groups across this country, they will tell you unequivocally that hate is spiking. And yes, it's possible we might have better data and a better record in part because of technology. But I think it's clear that hate is spiking in large measure because of the rhetoric and policies of this administration. When the president when the president bans Muslims and refugees and separates and cages immigrant families, it's going to cause a spike in hate in this country.
We have several comments from our Facebook page, including Mark, who writes, "American quote-unquote hate epidemic? ? Define hate epidemic," he writes. "Seems to me there's plenty of hate in places other than America." And Marshall writes, "The best thing to do is quit causing division in America through biased media, through fascist social platforms that silence the opposition." There are many examples in the book, people that you've spoken to, stories that you've gotten, actually people telling their own story. Can you give us one other story that stands out for you?
Sure. The story of Taylor Dumpson. Taylor Dumpson is an African-American woman who took the brave step of running for student body president at AU. And when she won, she became the first African-American woman to ever hold that position. And this is American University in Washington, D.C. This is 5-6 miles from the White House. The day that Taylor took office, nooses were found hanging across campus. And then days later, when she returned to her apartment, she found that she was being viciously cyber-trolled by the white supremacist neo-Nazi outfit, The Daily Stormer, and other blogs. And she talks in vivid detail about how she now suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder because of the hurt and pain that was caused to her by these various hate incidents.
We have another example, hate crime victims of foreign descent, like a gentleman named Deep Rai Singh, who was shot in Washington, often must deal with taunts of "go back to your country" along with physical attacks. But to Singh's brother, who we'll hear from here, Harji, America is their country and their home.
No American, real American, can say those kind of words. This is the time we hold each other's hand and we feel like this is our home, this is our country.
Is there something in your book, obviously these are American stories, but is there something in particular that is an American quality to this as opposed to a quality of human nature.
Are you referring to the hate that folks are experiencing?
I'm talking about the stories that you've heard, the stories that you report on, or the stories that you tell, or the people tell these stories. Do you sense that this has something specifically American about it, or are there examples in other countries? Well, we have this issue in this other country, and it kind of lines up the same way as it does here in the United States.
So one of the reasons that I think hate is spiking in this moment is because this country hasn't done the difficult work of confronting its dark past. I say on page one of the book that the United States of America was built on a hate crime and was furthered on additional hate crimes, including slavery, Jim Crow, and mass incarceration. And a lot of people want to ignore that history, rewrite that history, and I think that we have to confront it. We have to have difficult conversations about anti-Black and anti-Native racism because they are been institutionalized across our society.
How would that conversation, sorry to interrupt, but how would that conversation manifest itself? If you could write up the script, where does that conversation take place? As if it's, by inference, you're saying that conversation is not being held now.
Well, in some cases, conversations are being held. So in the wake of hate incidents, there are communities that are coming forward and saying we need to have town halls where we talk about not just the hate incident that just occurred 2 weeks ago, but about the hate that people have experienced in that county, in that city, in that state for years or decades. Across this country, there are communities that are coming together and having conversations about healing, about reparations, even something akin to truth and reconciliation committees. So these conversations are happening. Not enough of them are happening. But again, community local activists do this work every day, and they are helping survivors and helping vulnerable communities come forward and have some of these difficult conversations.
A few more comments from our Facebook page. Stephen writes, there's been a small spike, but long-term trends for hate crimes have been steadily decreasing ever since they were first reported. And Chris writes on our Facebook page, it's by far the worst I've seen in 40 years or so. When something like a drumpf, Chris's words, empowers them, they seem to come out of the woodwork. Arjun, stay with us. The book is called American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. We're talking about hate crimes in America and the motivating factors behind them. You can join the conversation. Is hate a growing epidemic in America, or has it always been like this? I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. We're discussing American hate crimes and the stories of survivors. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in the stories of hate crime survivors? Should we be trying harder to understand the perpetrators? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Arjun Singh Sethi. He's the editor of a new book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. And joining us now from New York is Vegas Tenold, a journalist who has studied white nationalist groups since 2011. He's the author of Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. The book came out in February this year. Vegas, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Bud. Thanks for having me.
Vegas, quickly, your take from what transpired yesterday in D.C.
I think it's important for us to recognize that although the Unite the Right Rally 2 was an abject failure in almost every single respect, it basically only means that the movement very much dislikes Jason Kessler. It should not lead us to believe that the movement is in trouble or decimated in any shape or form. It's still very much there. They just don't like to get together with the same guys they used to.
Now, during the Vice, there's a Vice documentary called Charlottesville, Race and Terror. A journalist named L. Reeve asked Robert Ray, a self-proclaimed neo-Nazi, what the Charlottesville demonstration meant for him. Here was his answer, and a warning, this content may be offensive to some.
Well, for one thing, it means that we're showing to this parasitic class of anti-white vermin that this is our country. This country was built by our forefathers. It's sustained by us. It's going to remain our country.
Vegas, the two events stand in stark contrast, obviously, with what happened, or shall we say, did not happen yesterday in D.C., and with what transpired in Charlottesville. What did the nationalist right, or however you want to frame them or term them, what did they take away from last year's events in Charlottesville?
I think they're still kind of struggling with getting their bearings a little bit. I mean, we have to remember that this new iteration of the far right in America, some people call it white nationalism 2.0, some people call it the alt-right, but whatever you want to call it, they're still a relatively new thing on the scene. And Charlottesville last year was their coming out party. And they learned a whole lot of lessons. They learned that there was going to be consequences for marching publicly. They learned the challenges of organizing. They learned about the realities of infighting and bickering in the movement. And I think they're still adjusting to that. We've seen the leadership has had a pretty rough year. The membership has retreated back into the catacombs of the internet. But they're still very much there. And I think we're seeing them kind of find their sea legs a little bit, if you will. So we're still kind of anticipating what they're going to turn into next.
No situation is simple, of course. Every situation, especially this one, and the topic of race in America, could not be more complex. But in the aftermath of Charlottesville, does it simply come down to the person who is going to join that rally all of a sudden is on TV? There are still photographs all over the internet, and perhaps someone shows up, as was the case in a recent ProPublica Frontline documentary, and confronts the person who is there, and the person loses their job within the next couple of days. Is it simply a reaction of, hey, I believe all this stuff, but I don't want that to happen? And besides, if some politicians might be saying some of the things that I want to say, can we just leave it at that? Is it really just come down to that after Charlottesville for the white nationalists?
I think you've touched on two really important points. Andrew Anglin, the editor of the Daily Stormer, he wrote an op-ed piece on his site leading up to Unite the Right 2, where he said that, you know, we definitely should not take part in this thing. We know that some people in the movement want to be doctors, they want to be politicians or police officers, and this will just ruin their future. There's a discussion happening in the movement right now about whether or not it's a smart idea to norm out, as they call it. That means blending in a way, to try to influence society that way. And it seems to be, for a lot of the people, that's the direction the movement is taking. On the other side, you have the rise in domestic terror organizations and explicitly violent groups such as the Proud Boys and Adam Waffen and the Rise Above movement. So there's a little bit of a split there. But also what you mentioned, I mean, the far right, the alt-right, wasn't the end goal in and of itself. It was a vehicle by which you introduce these ideas into the bloodstream of political America. And they've had some success in that. This year, there's a slew of far-right candidates running on basically white nationalist, white supremacist platforms. And that, to me, is very much the measure of the success. They really have people dipping their toes into the racist pool at the moment, seeing if they can get away with this now.
This is On Point. Our guest is journalist Vegas Tenold, joining us from New York. He studied white nationalist groups since 2011. And Arjun Singh Sethi, he is the editor of a new book entitled American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. Let's go to your phone calls now. Lydia is calling us from Ansonia, Connecticut. Sorry, Lydia. Lydia, welcome to On Point.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. I called because just as I tuned in, you had sort of thrown a question out. Is the hate something new, or has it always been there? and it's always been here. And I don't want to sound condescending or sarcastic, but it's obvious that it's always been here because who built our country? Africans who were enslaved and worked for free. And all you have to do is just look around to see, yes, racism is still here. And I think what's kind of interesting is that it shows its head in different ways. So, like, there were people that were really upset when Obama was president, you know, and they started coming out there. It was like the backlash. And now that 45 is president, they're just like more, they're more open and blatant. And they just have a fertile ground for saying and doing the hateful and violent acts that they do.
Lydia, thank you for your call. If I said earlier, has it always been here, that was my mistake, because obviously that's much too simplistic a statement or question to ask. I guess what we're really focusing on is what is different at this point, and that's part of what transpires in this book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. And obviously, Vegas, you have followed that as well over the last few years. Let's go back to your phone calls. Mike A.L. is calling from Florida. Mike A.L.
Yes, hello, Bud. It's a real pleasure. And hello, Mr. Vegas and Mr. Jinsing. I hope I got your name correct.
That's okay. What's your question?
Yes, your America's dark past. You see, we all have something in our past that we must confront, and most of us run away from it. And we must realize that this type of slavery mentality had originated economically. And until we face the facts that it was an economically driven ideology that perpetuated slavery to this extent where it's become institutionalized today.
Michael, thank you for your phone call. Arjun, one of the main themes of your book, as we've discussed, is that you think, and the people that you or tell their stories in your book think, that whatever existed before has been exacerbated in the last couple of years. But are there threads through their stories, the survivor stories, that surprised you, the stuff that would not come to the fore initially in terms of your thoughts about these stories, and then all of a sudden there was a thread from the Jewish woman in Montana to the African-American student in D.C. To the Lebanese Americans in Tulsa?
Absolutely. When I set out, I expected to find lots of pain and grief across this country, and I found that. But I also found that survivors across the board are resilient, optimistic, and hopeful. They are pushing back. They are having difficult conversations. They are holding anti-racism trainings. They are building community defense programs. They are working with young people so that they understand the values of racial justice, equity, and inclusion. They are working with technology companies to curb hate online. So in many ways, the book is titled American Hate. But there's also a lot of hope, too. And I think it's important to remember that.
We have a few more comments from our Facebook page, including a comment from Matthew, who asks, can white people be victims of hate crimes? Vegas, I'm going to throw that one to you.
I mean, sure, they can be victims of anti-LGBTQ hate crimes, religious hate crimes.
I would imagine the questioner from Facebook is asking along the lines of, if a person's attacked simply for being white.
I guess sure in theory, but sort of it becomes a little bit like the all lives matter argument, kind of to me. It helps to take away from the worthwhile debate we're having about real genuine hate crime in America. And yes, sure, a white person, I guess, can be attacked for the color of their skin. But white people aren't a class of people who are in trouble in any way, I think. So it becomes a little bit different. I mean, I'm probably going to get a lot of grief about this one online, but that's fine.
I think that comes with the territory online these days. Another comment from Facebook. Steven706 writes, are you so sure it is Trump and not the continual outrage of trying to delegitimize his elections that might not be playing a role in the increase? Let's go back to your phone calls now. Joe is calling from Waukesha, Wisconsin. Joe, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm a dual citizen. I was born in the U.S. 75 years ago, but I spent about 15 years in Canada in the meantime. And obviously, I find, particularly, I've been back now for over 25 years, and I find that things don't seem to change very much in this regard, that is the hatred. In other words, it seems to be just under the surface, the racism and the attitudes towards people of color. When you think that the person in the Oval Office started his campaign by denigrating Mexicans, so the whole issue of his campaign started with racism. And the thing that changes me, when I reflect on both societies, Canadian and U.S., that what we're going through now would be absolutely impossible in Canada. It's a different system of governments, parliamentary, so the man in the Oval Office couldn't even be considered. But the other issue that I think is extremely important to look at is the fact that we have people who are supposed to be serving and respecting the police in this country. For example, in Charlottesville, it was reported last year that police there stood around, many of them, some I'm sure got involved, but most stood around and did nothing. And I think one of the really serious problems, and it's gone on for generations with Native people, and obviously with African Americans, and that is the view, in particularly in the police departments, when you look at cities like Chicago, where there's enormous violence, and these murders are not solved, nothing like if a white kills a white. And I think part of the issue there is that people of color are looked upon as subhuman. And it's an issue with a lot of people that are prone to react the way they do, whites who have this crazy notion that they're being persecuted in this country. And I think it is a view that they see people of color, people, foreigners, anybody who's not American, and we know so little about the rest of the world. That's the other problem. We're so ignorant about the rest of the world. But I think this view of looking at citizens of our country, people of color, as I said earlier, that they are subhuman. So it doesn't matter. So police can stand around and watch people, say, in South Chicago being killed, but they don't even bother trying to find out who. And they,
Joe, that's a story. Joe, the Chicago story and most stories are a little bit more complex than that, than just the notion of standing around. I understand what you're saying about in terms of Charlottesville, but the notion of, at least in Chicago, of just standing around, I think obviously the people of Chicago and the officials of Chicago would obviously take issue with that. The Fox News talk show host Laura Ingraham came under fire recently for comments she made that demographic shifts related to both illegal and legal immigration have changed America for the worst.
Because in some parts of the country, it does seem like the America that we know and love doesn't exist anymore. Massive demographic changes have been foisted upon the American people. And they're changes that none of us ever voted for and most of us don't like.
Ingram's comments have been endorsed by David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the KKK, although the host has disavowed Duke's support. Regardless, for both of you, regardless of what's actually being said there, do you get a sense from white people that you've talked to about race that there's a difference? Obviously, someone who's going to go out and commit an act of violence, we're talking about something completely different, or to bring violence upon someone in the subway or on the street, but that the changes in the country are genuinely confusing to some people, perhaps an older generation, and that it takes them, they need to figure it out, or is it not too hard to figure out? You just don't have bigotry against someone who doesn't look like you.
One of the things I noticed when I was reporting on this was there was a change around 2015, 2016, when new people started showing up at these rallies. And there were these rallies happening at colleges and in affluent communities. And for as long as I'd covered it, the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, had always been these economically disenfranchised, lower educated, sort of conforming to all the stereotypes that you had. But all of a sudden, these rich, relatively intelligent, educated people started started going to these rallies, and I was curious as to, you know, what could their beef possibly be. And Laura Ingraham phrased it perfectly. I mean, it is this notion that America within the next 20 or 30 years might become a minority majority country. And that really is something that terrifies these people and fuels everything they do and fuels this entire movement.
Vegas, do you come upon people? Obviously, when you're covering white nationalist groups, that's one thing. But do you, in your work, also come upon people of like, look, I obviously don't support what those people are doing, but please understand my consternation here. Is that a phrase, maybe not consternation, but is that a sentiment that you hear?
Yeah. And I mean, they all have that sentiment. I mean, it's all, I'm not a racist, but, you know, even the most dyed-in-the-wool Klansmen will say like, oh, I have no problem with black people, but you have to admit that they pose a problem. You know, so they all have this kind of way of rationalizing it, but it all leads down into the same thing, and that is this fear of the other, fear of racism and xenophobia.
Again, Vegas Tenhold is a journalist who has studied white nationalist groups since 2011. Vegas, please stay with us. And the new book is called American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. It is edited by Arjun Singh Sethi. We're talking about hate crimes in America. You can join the conversation. What do you think about the president's tweet over the weekend condemning, and I quote here, all types of racism? I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
So you just woke up and you want to find out about the latest news. That is when you turn to Up First, the 10-minute news podcast from NPR News. Here, Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. We're talking about hate in America, and you can join the conversation. Would you sit down with someone who committed a hate crime against you? Have you experienced a change in your views after meeting with someone of a different nationality or a different faith? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Arjun Singh Sethi. He's the editor of a new book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. And Vegas Tenhold, a journalist who has studied white nationalist groups since 2011. Let's go back to your phone calls now. Firas is calling from Windsor, Ontario. Firas, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Bud. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So, I was born in Lebanon, and my parents left the Civil War. I have dealt with discrimination my whole life, but not too many occurrences. I had two before Trump was elected my whole life, pretty much. After Trump was elected, I've counted about 8 or 9 at this point.
Did you find that they were like the same types of incidents, or was the passion, the emotion, the severity of them, had they changed at all?
So I find that it's not that there's more racist people out there, it's that people feel like they can speak out to these things now.
Okay, Firas, thank you for your phone call. Let's go back to your calls now. John is calling from Clarksville, Georgia. John, thank you for joining us On Point.
Hello, how are you, sir?
Good.
I'm a retired Chicago police officer, retired after 35 years. And I keep hearing this, you know, everything about our relationships. Now, I understand that there is problems where police officers and or municipalities violate civil rights. But the police are getting a really bad rap. And so much of it, it seems to be one-sided. You listen to, you know, public radio, it's all liberal. You listen to Fox, it's all conservative. And it doesn't seem like there's a middle ground. I would just like to say that when I got on the job in 66, I was a 20-year-old, very naive, middle-class American white boy. And I had literally bottles, stones, and everything else thrown at me. And all I wanted to do was help. There were wonderful people in the minority community, but there were a lot of really, you know, people who just didn't, just hated me. And that doesn't seem to come across. We need to sit there and really talk, everybody, and quit being so biased on each side. That's right. My whole comment.
Well, that's okay, John. I want to ask you a question. You don't know me from Adam, but let's make the assumption for 1 second here that I am unbiased and have listened to the stories of people who served on police forces and reported their stories and listened to people who have a problem with their particular police force and heard their stories as well. If from your experience, understanding that you're now retired, but from your experience, were someone to come to you, someone of power and influence, and say, we are giving you the opportunity to try and resolve a very complex situation between the police, and I realize that's a broad term, that's a little bit too broad, and communities, primarily African-American, Latino, poor communities in our cities, is there something that you think should be put in place or a particular policy that might help, might be a resolution to the situation?
You know, I have to go back to the educational system in this country. And we do not teach critical thinking. Everybody listens to, you know, the person who wants to scream the loudest. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to mention names, you know, because this goes on both sides. But everybody seems to listen to them, and then they say, oh, yeah, well, he or she said blah, blah, blah. They cannot seem to think for themselves. And we have to teach people to think.
John, thank you for your phone call today. John calling from Clarksville, GA. Arjun, in your research for this book and you're hearing people's stories, is it just kind of a given that when you dealt with people of color that there was an issue with local police, or did you find occasions when the local police and the people that you were talking to had a solid relationship and it was a mutually helping relationship?
So it really depended on the survivor. So there are folks in the book who immediately after a hate crime called the police, and prosecutors then prosecuted the suspect and put the person in jail. So after a mosque in Victoria, Texas was burned to the ground, the local law enforcement investigated the crime and actually just convicted somebody a few weeks ago. But let me give you another example. Surat Swang is another person profiled in the book. He is the executive director of a group called the Providence Youth Student Movement. After their offices were vandalized in Providence, Rhode Island, and by vandalized I mean a noose was hanging from the ceiling, their equipment was rearranged, and knives were stabbed into the desk, they decided not to call the police. Because they are an abolitionist organization, and they believe that so much of the violence that communities of color and others experience in this country come at the hands of the state, that during their time of need, they shouldn't be asking the police for their help. So they doubled down on a neighborhood watch program, self-defense classes, and a buddy check-in program. So it really just depends on the survivor. But I will say this. State violence and hate violence are inseparable. So long as the Trump administration bans Muslims and refugees, cages and separates immigrant families, rolls back protections for transgender students, rolls back Title IX reforms, rolls back consent agreements that keep police departments accountable, everyday Americans are going to continue to target us because the government has put a target on our back.
And it's also in that line of thinking I've also heard from police and prosecutors is that we are asking the police to do so much more than just doing their individual police work. I want to transition now to getting to some of the macro issues and get Vegas Tenold back in the conversation. A former skinhead, Arno Michaelis, who has helped many escape, so-called escape white nationalist groups, broke down the recruiting message often used to attract new white nationalist members.
I think a big thing fueling hate group membership nowadays is the rhetoric from the White House. This rhetoric that immigrants are dangerous, that Islam is dangerous, that's all like the same kind of speech that we used 20 years ago in what we called the movement.
Vegas, is the genie, shall we say, out of the bottle? In other words, regardless of what transpires in elections in 2018, looking at a few years to 2020, is there a notion that what has transpired over the last 2 or 3 years, whether you want to place it specifically at the door of the Trump administration, or whether you say as a Trump supporter, no, there's always been racism in this country, is there something different that's transpired over the last couple of years that will not be so easily brought back?
I think so. I mean, society is governed by norms and to a large degree unwritten rules. And I think we've sort of thrown a lot of those norms away in the last couple of years. You know, I do think that as racist and as intolerant and as bigoted the man in the Oval Office is, you know, he isn't the cause of this. He is the end result of this so far. Like he was just a guy who saw an opportunity to sell racism to a larger crowd, and he took it. The country itself was ready to listen. I don't know what we're going to do forward, but I do think we're going to have a problem sticking this genie back in the bottle. I just want to mention a quick story. I was at a barbecue with a bunch of neo-Nazis back in 2011, and their leader was telling me about how the country was ready to listen to what they had to say. They were ready to vote along racial lines, along gender lines. They were ready to sort of, the white man was ready to wake up. All they needed was a candidate to sell that message. And I thought, you know, I thought he was insane. We just elected Barack Obama, but he was talking about Donald Trump. So Donald Trump he's not the cause of this. He's a direct result, and we should have seen it coming a long time ago.
Vegas, I want to go back to something you just said. And obviously, as a reporter, you find yourself in situations and in positions that perhaps you never thought you were going to be in when you first started on this quest of being a reporter. But just that phrase alone, I was at a barbecue with neo-Nazis. Tell me what that's about. Where was it? How do you do that? How do you have a barbecue with neo-Nazis?
Well, I mean, I've been to so many. I've eaten a lot of awful food. I once got fed possum at a Klan rally in North Carolina. This particular one was in 2011 in Trenton, New Jersey. It was with a group called the National Socialist Movement. I believe I described it in one of the early chapters of my book. But that's kind of been the MO of my work here, just trying to spend as much time with these people as possible, go to where they are, not just cover them in public rallies or in interview situations, but sort of do a fly on the wall thing and really see how they live their lives. So yeah, it's been a lot of bad house parties and barbecues and cross lightings and a slew of other things.
Any friends and family along the way who have said to you, "Look, I got it. I got it. This is your job. I got it that you're trying to figure out who these people are and what this cause is all about. But at the end of the day, I just don't understand it."
I mean, every single day, and a lot of the, you know, the darker and the scarier episodes that I encountered, I didn't tell them about until they read the book. Yeah, I mean, I get it. And for me, the end of the book was the last piece of writing I did for the book was Charlottesville. And by that time, I did feel like I was done at that point. But I mean, this is a troll that's going to keep bedeviling us in society for a long time to come. So we're never done dealing with these people.
The book Vegas is referring to is Everything You Love Will Burn: Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America, which came out in February this year. ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson, who has covered white supremacists and was part of the recent ProPublica Frontline documentary on Charlottesville, tied the white nationalist movement to deeper-seated issues among white Americans.
And so one thing is, I think that they're reflective of a deeper fissure in society. That's a key thing, right? Is that they are the extreme edge of a deeper movement and a deeper unease. And I think there's a lot of white people who have, to some extent, in the last few years, said, hey, I'm unhappy about illegal immigration. I'm unhappy about immigration, period, and have sort of returned to this nativist, racist rhetoric. And these guys are the most extreme version of it.
A couple of quick comments from Twitter. David writes, hate is weaponized fear. Fear goes with uncertainty, doubt, and ignorance, which are being cultivated for power and control. And Nathan writes about a comment from about 20, 30 minutes ago to the interviewee's comment, us white men can definitely be discriminated against or prejudiced against or whatever, but I feel like we need to get over ourselves. As Nathan writes, we've had a pretty good run on top, and it's time to share. Arjun, here comes the cliched, traditional broadcaster, open, generic question. Where do we go from here?
Well, first and foremost, we need to make sure that those who are most impacted in this moment have the resources they need to move forward. I met survivors who don't have access to healthcare, mental health support. You know, people don't understand that in the wake of a hate crime, survivors are thrust into this terrifying spotlight. Looking on are the media, the public. Lawyers want to speak to them. Law enforcement need to speak to them. Some survivors that come forward are accused of fabrication and are cyberbullied and trolled online. So we need to make sure that survivors have what they need. We need to make sure that impacted communities have what they need. Survivors, hate crimes don't just impact survivors. They impact communities at large. So making sure they have the resources. I think we also just need to have a larger conversation about white supremacy in this country, because really, it's been here for as long as this country has existed. We need to make sure there are strong hate crime laws in every state. And then revisiting a point I made earlier, we have to dismantle these state policies that treat vulnerable communities as suspect. When it comes to policies like the Muslim ban, immigration raids, and the separation and caging of families, these are destructive policies that violate civil and human rights. And if the president does it, and his advisors do it, and law enforcement does it, so will everyday Americans.
Vegas, we'll give you the last word. Again, A, where do we go from here? And B, perhaps more specifically, is there something about this story that we are not talking about, that you are looking at going forward? Something that, for whatever reason, has not been the subject of a conversation post-Charlottesville and in the, not 24 hours, but say 12 hours, 18 hours since the rally that really was not a rally in D.C.?
I mean, I think we need to be looking at how white supremacy is rearing its head at the moment in other arenas, in the political arena. But what I want to say is, like, look, I get it. As a white person, it can be uncomfortable to deal with notions of white supremacy, systemic white supremacy, the history of racism in this country, and white privilege. It's uncomfortable, and it should be uncomfortable, and it's easy to say that, you know, but look at what Black Lives Matter are doing, or look at what Antifa are doing. They're just as bad. But we need to acknowledge that most people in this country haven't had the luxury of sort of being able to ignore racism the way we have. You know, we can say that, you know, well, let's have a civilized conversation about this, or let's not take to the street and let's not be angry or fueled by rage. But this has been something that's been simmering for since this country was created, and we need to realize that the rage has legitimacy and it's coming from somewhere.
And I suffice it to say that I don't think it's hyperbole to say that we can have this discussion that we've had for the past hour. We can have it next week. We can have it next month, next year, and for years to come. Vegas Tenhold is a journalist and author of Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. Vegas, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Bud.
And Arjun Singh Sethi, a civil rights lawyer, and he's the editor of a new book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. Arjun, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.